long, long day. I got a lot to say. It feels like I'm carrying a two-ton weight. I go to see a friend.
Hello, I'm Monsignor Patrick Winslow.
And I am Father Matthew Kauth.
And we are speaking from the rooftop.
A podcast brought to you by Tan Books, in which we invite you to join our conversation out here in the open air,
where we look out upon the world around us from the rooftop of the church and share with you what we see.
Makes me wanna scream.
Hello. So, all right.
It makes me laugh every time. You're just like, well, hello.
Yeah, well, hello.
Hello.
So, we're on the rooftop of the church looking out in the world.
We are.
Please tell me what you see.
What do I see? I see right now the feast of St. Patrick and the way in which everyone.
And on the horizon, St. Joseph.
So I thought we might want to talk a little bit about, from our vantage point, how one celebrates Saints' Days, and how the Church once regulated, and to some degree still does, her seasons by virtue of various saint days. Because I think one of the things it's really difficult to fathom is that planting crops, harvesting, various things throughout the year were all done on certain saints' days because that's when it always happened. But it became so ingrained in the people. We have this idea, a modern idea, of course, that there was this thing called the church and there's this thing called the state and they were part of your wellness wheel, pieces in the pie, as if the faith wasn't imbued in every possible sector of life. Which was a bit confusing when they began to mess around with the calendar because you also messed around with people's long traditions relative to these things. But two saints' days that have stayed the same and have stood the test of time for a while anyway.
You mean stayed the same on the calendar?
On the calendar, and which have clear, one has huge implications for everyone, that is today, which is a Friday in Lent, and the other one
the
is rather new.
The feast of St. Patrick, because by the time this airs, we'll be well past it.
Exactly. But St. Patrick today, St. Joseph on the 19th, whereas St. Joseph is a relatively new feast, not in itself per se, but in its widespread celebration. So, since you are named Patrick, maybe you want to begin with the nature of celebrating Saints' Days, but also celebrating St. Patty's Day.
My earliest memory...
That's a long time ago. Go back to black and white.
So my earliest memory of celebrating St. Patrick's Day really goes back to the time when McDonald's used to offer the Shamrock Shake. And there was a special, or at least my family told me there was a special, that if you proved in some way that your name was Patrick, they would give you one for free. Now, this
is probably the reason your dad named you Patrick.
That's true. Just for the benefit.
He's so cheap.
That's true. Just for the benefit. Well, and so I remember telling my grandmother I wanted to go, right? It's a big deal. It's St. Patrick's Day. My name's Patrick. I get a free Shamrock Shake. But, you know, now that I look back at it, I suspect my grandma just paid for the shake,
but
it was probably just something that was told to me. That said, it should have been free for all of us Patricks out there. You know, I don't know what St. Matthew's Day would bring about, but
nothing.
Maybe a small fry.
No, it's tax day.
It's tax day. You pay more. Good point. Well, but you know, it's amazing how something as simple as that. Seared into my memory. So we often think about penitential time, but we don't always think about how we celebrate feasts. The notion of sacred time, I mean, it's even in the Code of Canon Law, right? We talk about sacred time and how we observe time and times of year. But that notion, we don't often look at. we were sort of caught in the current of a custom or a tradition. So St. Patrick's Day for me growing up, I remember corned beef and cabbage. It was going to happen, right? It wasn't like we all look forward to it the way you would look forward to a Thanksgiving turkey, but you just knew that you were going to have corned beef and cabbage because that's what you do. And when I was a kid, I also remember every Friday being no meat.
Sure.
So that's where I developed my total aversion to the flavor of fish.
It probably wasn't fish.
It was a fish stick. And that is the really one of the nastiest flavors that I've ever had to endure. And so as a kid, that was, I would take fasting all day long, and I'm a man who loves food. I would take fasting all day long to avoid that flavor. Now, I have entered into nicer fishes, and the way I get around it is
you sound like Jonah. I have entered into nicer fishes.
Nicer fishes. But I think of like salmon or sea bass. I'm like, they're not really fish. But that's how I get over my mental hurdle. It was that bad. But that said, I have a distinct memory of Fridays not having meat. I have a distinct memory of St. Patrick's Day having corned beef and cabbage. I have distinct memory about Christmas Eve and Christmas Day dinners. And food then becomes very much a part of how we celebrate these feasts. Obviously, we should involve prayer. Obviously, we should involve actually reflecting upon the saint or the particular sacred occasion. But the way in which we manifest that joy and celebration, rightly named feasts, is by feasting.
Right. No, so true. I think that the fish notion growing up every Friday, of course, that was the church's discipline and still is to some degree. You can substitute it, as you all know, but unfortunately, probably few of us think to substitute it with anything significant. And so
Lent. Lent, it's required. Outside of Lent, you can substitute something else.
And the problem with that individual choice is, understandable as it is just that it you lost something culturally.
Yeah.
Because people did things together. You didn't get a choice. And that was part of the goodness of it, is that everyone was in the same boat. And so we have that sense in Lent, but it's the reason that typically the McDonald's or whatever would have the fish fillet. There's no other reason to have that fish fillet except people didn't eat meat on Fridays. It's the reason you had all kinds of things that the Knights of Columbus would and still put on, right? Related to fish fries and things like that. So it just created a kind of cultural adhesion.
And that's from a kid's perspective, really. That's what we're talking about. Because quite honestly, today, I was excited to hear the officer readings, the writing of St. Patrick.
Right.
So now that I'm an adult, I have an appreciation for the life of the saint. It's not just about corned beef and cabbage.
No, but if you can have both, right?
Well, that's because, it. It is both.
Yeah. Sometimes the nature of the faith gets approached almost too cerebrally and not so much viscerally, that we create these things in culture that everyone gets to be a part of. I mean, Italian culture, of course, traditionally, you know, we're coming up on St. Joseph's, and they have very specific food that you only get on the Feast of St. Joseph. Mm-hmm.
The Zeppoli.
Yeah.
And the raisins.
And lots of different feasts that had the same sort of thing. And it typically was, not always, but typically tied to that's exactly the kind of time in which this thing was available. Mm-hmm. We're so used now to being able to basically get any kind of food any time of year, but the Italians still do have a sense of this is what you eat at this time of year, that time of year. And it you know, became embroidered into the lives of these various feast days of the saints. And I love that because you realize you're not going to get that again. That's the one time, which we kind of do with turkey. Like, how many people make a turkey the rest of the year? And you may want to throw that out, say, I don't even like turkey. On some level, it doesn't matter. We all try to do a better job of a turkey every year and try to come up with a new recipe. But it's just the fun of doing it.
And knowing that everyone, all these people that you don't know, are going to the grocery store for the same reason. You, doing the same sort of thing. Yeah. It does breed a type of community among people of some common purpose.
Yeah.
And so it has deeper significance in the life of the faithful as manifesting a type of communion that is deeper, but these are fruits of that.
Right,
You know, it makes a lot of sense that the actual feasting, yeah, it's part of celebrating a feast day. But as a kid, I never woke up and said, hey, I can't wait to learn or think about St. Patrick today. I mean, right, you know, it was a shamrock and it was the shake, it was, you know, one of those little leprechauns, you know, it was a lot of green.
A lot of green.
You go through your teenage years and college years, it's all about green beer and things like that.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question, isn't it? You wonder, to some degree, to the extent to which we have dropped these things.
Yeah.
In some ways, it is the extent, Fulton Sheen used to say, you know, we dropped the beads, meaning the rosary, and people started hanging them up. Mm-hmm. We dropped, he would go through a list of things saying that these were cultural artifacts that were driven by a cohesion to a faith that we dismissed or dropped or lost the meaning of. And since the world has no real things to sort of bring it together, the secular realm, they've picked them up, but then they infuse them
with secular,
secular values.
Which
so the green beer, the partying, the carnevale, which literally means say goodbye to meat, right? Because used to our fast used to be more serious. And so a carnival, a carnevale, or Mardi Gras, which is literally what, Fat Tuesday.
Yeah. They get co-opted. And the Christians used to be the one co-opting the secular culture.
Yes.
But you're right. It is a flip. And, you know,
and they've taken them and they love it.
Of course.
Mean, the whole world loves St. Paddy's Day.
Well, they like Mardi Gras. They like
we don't
Saint
think
Day,
about St. Paddy's Day, right? St. Patrick. Just like all the names that you have in Spanish colonial culture, right? Mm-hmm. From Sacramento to Los Angeles, right? To San Diego, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No one thinks about those places as having anything to do with the faith. But of course, they did.
They did.
And we've lost it.
Absolutely.
Now, that being said, not to be dour, I guess the question then becomes,
too late for that.
how do we regenerate? Because I don't think it, yes, you can do it in terms of your family, and you should. You should have those saints that you're particularly devoted to, the saints to whom your kids are devoted to, especially if your children have any particular devotion to a saint, but also their name day, which is still a part of most of Western Catholic culture, celebrating one's name day, one's saint's name. Also their confirmation saints, etc. Those should be particularly highlighted in the course of a family's year. And it could be special things you only get at that time. That's a great way to do it. I do think, though, it's still sort of lacking that it doesn't make other people do it or invite other people to do it. And so that's one thing ecclesial, or even in terms of a parish, you could sort of institute that these are certain feasts in a parish, which, you know, you did at St. Thomas, for example, the World Feast, because we had so many nationalities there, mm-hmm. but which is not celebrating a particular saint, but just another.
It was the conclusion of our Fatima devotions.
It was, the Fatima
devotions.
So it
was the first Saturday after October 13th, the miracle.
Because Our Lady's Fatima is for everyone.
And it's universal, it's a universal devotion.
And before that, at the other parish, you had the wonderful Italian Fest.
Which no one was Italian.
Was that St. Gennaro's, or was it?
I don't even know what day we did it on.
Yeah, okay.
I can't remember. It actually corresponded to a sweet spot in the local calendar.
Gotcha.
But that said, it was a wonderful occasion. Of course, these things are a lot of work.
They're a lot of work.
Which means they will go to the wayside if you don't show up and pull them off.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm disappointed a bit that things got scaled back on some of my efforts to bring something to it. But I grew to bring these types of festivals, these feasts to parish life. They get turned into picnics and things like that, which is just a bit small ball. It's not quite the same.
Yeah.
So I grew up with feasts. You know, there was the Feast of Our Lady of Fatima. There was the Feast of St. Anthony's. And people would go to them. They would go out for days. They would start like on a Thursday. They'd go Thursday, maybe a Friday, but definitely a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But they could start earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And there would definitely be food that you wouldn't get anywhere else.
Yeah.
And up in upstate New York, you'd also have some gambling, a gambling tent, you know, things like that. That was just, that was part of the culture. So you had all sorts of things that were going on. They bring in a carnival, you know, with the rides.
Yes, right.
Everybody looked forward to it. The town, Catholics and non-Catholics, would be sorely disappointed without it.
Right.
The easy thing to do is not do it.
Right.
The easy thing to do is to say, well, consider all the work we put into it. It's not a really a money raiser, you know, a fundraiser, because if you consider the hours of labor, we're all working for less than minimum wage in order to generate this income. But that's not why you do it.
Right. Right. Exactly. We did.
I can't even imagine a life where those feasts and festivals didn't happen. But yet people in many dioceses are growing up where these things are like relics of the past.
Yes. And this is a hugely problematic in the fact that we have the vast majority of people who would consider themselves fairly lonely, because there aren't those sort of social invitations to be part of something. And you know, I was reading a book recently, a really interesting book, just about the sort of disconnectedness of the youth relative to, they've only grown up with social interactions on their phone. And so they don't have meaningful conversations with people oftentimes, and they're quite content on some level with not doing that, which is massively problematic for the future. Yeah. But it's not that hard to create, but it does take work. I remember at a parish I had in the mountains when I was up there, someone came up to me and just talked about a festival he had when he was a kid, which was for Corpus Christi. And instead of doing the flower petal images upon which you would walk with the monstrance, right, as part of the procession for Corpus Christi, his parish did sawdust. And they would color sawdust, tons and tons of sawdust. And they would color it all kinds of different shades. And they would design things and lay them out on these quote-unquote chalk carpets. And you'd take the different colors and you would fill them in almost like a crayon sort of book, right? And I said, let's do it. Let's try it. And he organized it. He was great at it. And it became a parish custom, you know, for 5, 6, 7 years. And to the point where I had kids, you know, that started it when they were 3 or 4. And then, you know, they get to 7, 8, or 9. They just assume, right, that this is what everyone does.
Oh, for them, it's
at
always
that time of year.
That way.
And you infuse it with all kinds of, you know, I mean, as soon as you've walked through with the Blessed Sacrament, then you walk back out with cotton candy, pretzels, you know, you name it. You gotta give some incentive.
Absolutely.
But unfortunately, that was stopped too. But in his parish, he said it had gone on for like 100 years that they had done this thing.
And you would never imagine not doing it.
Yeah.
Right? It just would be something you wouldn't do. It's the same sort of thing. You know, for Christmas time, I think at Christmas time, it's hard to imagine our society and our culture not having the decorations and the lights and things like that. That said, it all needs to be rooted in something deeper and more meaningful.
Right.
All needs to be connected. If it is, it's just a powerful synergy across the board. It's the way life should be led, with a sense of sacred time, a sense of a rhythm of a week, of a year, a sense of a rhythm of the seasons of the church and the feasts of the church. It's a natural sense, right? These rhythms are natural, and we build upon them, and we co-opt nature to reflect a higher meaning, a higher significance, an eternal rhythm, if you will, and eternal realities. I remember reading about Ratzinger when he was a boy. He commented what it was like growing up in a community in, was it Marktel Inn? I think that's where he was raised, in Marktel Inn, southern Bavaria, Germany. He commented about how Catholicism was the great equalizer, the faith was a great equalizer. He said, you would show up on Saturday, and in the same confession line would be a humble manual worker and the most wealthy person in town, all standing there as sinners, waiting to go and confess and to humble themselves before God.
And all knelt the same rail.
They knelt the same rail. They confessed to the same God, that it was equalizing, that there was something so profoundly impactful about that notion.
Right, that we all have various roles of stewardship under God and levels of authority that are just participations in the only one who has authority, who is Him.
But in the end.
But you're all in the end attempting to work for the common good, and you're
at His mercy.
You're at His mercy.
At His service. Yeah. And then I would imagine that would inspire, it should have inspired a sense of respect and dignity from somebody who had a higher social status or economic situation toward those who were in lesser
yes.
rungs, and not breed as much animus as one may have if in the reversal, where somebody might be lesser economic condition or lesser social level, because they see each other as dealing with the same fabric of life, the same eternal realities.
Well, and we can speak to this as priests too. I mean, it's interesting that we're professionally, at times, we've spoken about this many times, we're sort of professionally devotional. In other words, mm-hmm. we're sacramentally configured to be able to give God's gifts to his people. And as a result, it's part of your Opus Dei, it's part of your labor, your work of God to do that. And as a matter of fact, there's a great line from a book I once read called Judith's Marriage. And this woman in the book is converting, and her first experience of Catholicism and beginning this process, she goes to a mass and she sees this priest walk up there and sort of lay out his chalice and mess with a book, and sort of he's dressed up in these clothes she doesn't understand. And she described it as, it seemed as if he was a plumber who walked up there with his toolbox, you know, laid him out on the altar, unleashed, you know, got the waters working, opened the taps, closed the taps back off, and then put everything back into his toolbox, and then went home. And that's true professionally. Right? You and I are conduits of that for the people of God. And as devotional as that can be for us personally, it need not be, because we can do the work without it participating in the work. And the reason I bring that up is that one of the things I think is so interesting as priests that you and I can have engaged in before, whether it's the Fatima processions at the parish or actual pilgrimages, the thing that's always struck me about pilgrimages, especially when I was living in Rome and I saw so many priests come, is to watch the priests with the faithful doing something devotional.
Yeah.
Where they're not sort of leading by virtue of a sacrament and as it were unleashing like a plumber those waters of grace. But they're walking up on their knees. They're touching their rosary to a saint's tomb, right? They're kneeling down praying the rosary itself or devotionally beholding the body of a saint or et cetera. I love watching and having the opportunity myself to do things with the faithful that we're all kind of at that same communion rail.
To see the shepherd as a pilgrim.
Yeah.
You know, that's very important. I also like devotions and acts of piety because they're coming from ourselves, they're coming from within, and they're gestures toward God by our own initiation. Whereas when you go to Mass, you're fundamentally on the receiving end.
Right.
You are receiving Christ's offering and sacrifice, his body and blood. You're receiving him. And, you know, to be quite honest, he's the one doing the work.
Yeah.
We go there and we are served.
Right.
Same thing with any of the other sacraments. But when you have a devotion, like, for example, the Fatima devotion, where we had these processions on the 13th of the month from May 13th to October 13th, the time of the apparitions of Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal, when we did those, you went and you gave. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about receiving. Mm-hmm. It was about you giving. And I have to say, if anyone had requested that we had a Mass as part of that devotion, I would have said no.
Right.
Because it would have changed that.
Right.
And again, I'm a big fan of daily Mass.
Of course, absolutely.
And you know, that's the thing that hooked me in my life is daily Mass. But you also need opportunity to give.
Right. And to be creative in that giving. I mean, you know, there's no question about, you know, a conscious and active role relative to the Holy Mass. That is to say, I'm uniting my sacrifices. I'm uniting my will.
You put something into it.
I'm participating. Yeah. I'm putting something in. I'm kneading my sufferings, as it were, into that bread before it's consecrated. I'm trying to offer. But it is ultimately his sacrifice at which we come to adore and to receive. And as you say, with the devotions, there's something that's sort of uniquely creative about them. in our response to what we did at Holy Mass. Like, I'm going to bake this thing. I'm going to make this carpet. I'm going to
have this festivity. What do you mean by carpet? You mean the chalk.
The chalk carpet. So the flower
carpet. That you would walk on and destroy
Corpus
them
Christi,
with
right?
your feet.
With your feet, which seems so incredibly...
Right, it's a sacrifice. It's an offering.
It's wonderful. In this simple but beautiful way in which communities across Christendom have always responded to God's gifts. They have come up with things to say, now it's our turn.
Yeah.
Now we want to give you this. This is why it takes work and why it's not about the bottom line or the finance or whatever else. So I don't mean to throw any of our brother priests, you know, under the bus and so as to say, go out to your priest and tell him, let's do these devotions or whatever else. It shouldn't be something the priest organizes, frankly. Mm-hmm. Right? It should be something that the faithful organize, mm-hmm. that the priest can support, that you come with these various saints' days or whatever's important to the parish, to the people of your parish, et cetera, and say, let's start something. And it can be small, but let it be consistent and get people on board with you offering something back to our Lord in honor and praise of the saint and his work in that saint or this particular feast day or whatever the case may be. Such that the parish is a place where we don't just come to Holy Mass, but it's the place where we're going to go give something to our Lord with consistency.
Yes. And the way in which you could get something started, the right way to get something started, would be not to go to your priest and say, hey, we should be doing this.
Exactly.
Because what the priest hears is...
You should be doing this.
You should be doing this, right? The priest hears somebody telling them another thing they need to do. But if you go to your parish priest and you say, look, I think this would be a really good idea. What do you think? I'd be willing to organize it, make it happen. But it can't be so priest-dependent that it becomes almost like another event on the schedule. It really ought to be the devotion of the faithful. Now, it doesn't mean that there isn't a place for the priest
to lead or
to be a part of it. But if needed, a deacon could step in, or if needed... You know, even a seminarian on a summer assignment could be able to pull something off, that sort of thing. If you approach it that way, if that is your request, you might get somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, what really priest doesn't love to walk into his church, his parish center, his whatever, where he's stationed and see people praying, see people doing these acts of devotion to our Lord. I just did a parish mission at a local parish here. And it was striking. The parish is open all day long. It doesn't close until 9 p.m. And you know, I went there throughout various parts of the day, and I don't think I ever went in there and didn't see people praying.
I think that's the way it should be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think doors to churches should be open. I think we have enough technology these days to monitor and to keep secure.
Yes.
Cameras, alarms, things like that. I mean, even some parishes that have perpetual adoration, the people who go, they know the code, and it's this little punch code to be able to get in. I think we can use technology enough. I don't like the excuse for security and safety purposes, we throw a bolt.
And, well, it's funny you say that, because I just finished a trip outside this diocese, and I tried to three different churches. They were all locked, so I called some more. Mm-hmm. And every single church said, I just want to go pray.
Yeah.
And yes, I can pray in my room. And I did. But I was on the road and I really wanted to be able to pray before the Blessed Sacrament. Mm-hmm. And the churches that I called said the same thing. For security purposes, we don't open up until 10 minutes before Mass. And we lock up right after it.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, this one place I was traveling was probably the highest income per capita place I've ever been in my life.
Right, right.
There was not exactly
a lot of risk, threat of danger. See, if I were a wealthy benefactor, I think I would make a restricted donation toward a church project, that the doors of the church would have to be open. That I'd be happy that a portion of whatever funds that I gave would go to the security system to allow for that to be done safely. But honestly, why raise all of this money among the faithful to build a church that have these slim, narrow windows?
I know.
No.
Right. These are places to go anytime.
This is for the faithful. Open the doors.
Yes, open the doors. Amen.
Let us in.
Amen.
What is wrong with those priests?
Preach it, brother. Preach it.
What is wrong with those priests?
You know, some disgruntled parishioners are going to be sending this to our various brother priests and saying, these priests say
you should say. I know. Well, listen, I'll throw you under the bus. I say, well, that Father Kauth was mimicking me and I didn't really say that.
That's right.
We
know that there's always difficulties, but it can happen and it must happen to keep these churches open.
No, it's true. And honestly, I have no problem making that argument to our brother priests. It's so important. It is. It's almost to the level of a pet peeve. Mm. You know, I'm principally opposed to the notion, but I'm so irritated by it. It's almost as though pet peeves are escalating something from principle to something even higher. It peeves me.
Well, good. You're in a position to do something about it.
Oh, I hate that kind of work.
Well, before we go, Father.
Yes.
What you were just talking about reminded me of a beautiful little story that I recall when I lived in Rome. For the most part, there are some Roman churches, 500 churches in the vicinity of Rome. I mean, a lot of churches. And obviously, a lot of them are locked. And some of them are locked at odd hours of the day, and they're all locked at night. A couple churches have some night adoration, etc. But there was one church down from where I lived, and he would stay open till like 11 o'clock or midnight.
The church?
The church itself would.
So the priest would keep the church open?
He kept it open. And it was right on a very busy shopping thoroughfare, a little close to the Trevi Fountain. So imagine how many people come by there.
Sure.
So he's attempting to provide an oasis that's
people
close to
there for
people
maybe
stop in to be quiet.
To pray.
And to pray.
Devotion.
What was really interesting about that church is 24/7, 365 days a year, he had Christmas music playing.
Was it recognizable?
It was. And
it's not like old-fashioned Christmas music where it sounds
no, like chant. No. It was. Some of that too, but it was mostly things you would recognize.
So there were like Christmas carols.
Quite a few, and some in English, even in Italy, right? I don't know where. I don't know how he put his musical selection together.
He probably put his first and only selection together during the Christmas season, and just has it on a loop.
So I did find a way to ask someone in that church one time, and this is kind of an interesting response. Because the music was kind of piped out from the church. Like once you got in, you didn't really hear it.
So it was almost a hook.
It was a hook.
To pull people in.
And the idea was that everyone loves Christmas music.
Isn't that right?
I thought that was so clever.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of got sick of it. But I loved the zeal. I loved the idea. He just wanted people to go into his church and pray. And people did.
All right. Well, then on my last thing, I'll kind of pick up on that thought. In essence, what this priest is doing, he isn't preaching to these people, but he's letting the church itself preach to them. Mm-hmm. All of the sacred elements, all of the sacred images, the atmosphere, the feel, the way prayer sticks to the walls and to the seats.
Right.
As a kid, I can bear witness to how powerful a church can have an impact. As a child, when I went to church, in fact, I could say pretty much up until I was about 20, I don't think I ever remembered a single word a priest ever said at any homily. They could have been the most beautiful orations, the most important and poignant things spoken. But as a kid,
that's right.
I remember the church.
That's right.
Because my eyes were all over it.
That's right.
And when we would go to some of the really more beautiful ornate churches,
yes,
it leaves an impression on you.
Oh, I remember the very first time I went back home with you. Mm-hmm. We were in seminary, and you just took me from one church to another. And conversely, I grew up in a Pizza Hut.
Yeah.
And it had an impression.
Yeah, it speaks.
Yeah, it had a huge impression. The old adage is that we form our buildings and then the buildings form us.
Yeah.
And that's true. Especially the imagination for a child.
Oh yeah, that's the truth. And so very very clever idea, this man, to allow the church to be able to evangelize and using the Christmas music and an open door as a hook and a net.
Yep.
It's fantastic.
It was.
Good for him.
Yeah. I don't think he's listening, but in case he is,
well bravo.
Done. Bravo.
Bravo. I'll stop in. Now I'm going to go look for it. In fact, you probably just boosted among the tens of people that listen to us, boosted
the traffic to his church.
Traffic to his church as part of a destination
well,
for pilgrims.
You know, drop a euro in there and help him with the upkeep.
Yeah.
So you happen to go there.
Do you remember the name of the church?
Next time
we need to circle back. Do you remember it now?
I think I do, yeah.
We'll confirm it.
Check it.
We'll check it on the map, make sure we get it right. Watch. The pastor has probably been moved on and it's somebody else who locks the door. But hopefully it's still happening.
Yeah, amen. Have a blessed week, everyone.
All right.
A blessed feast of St. Patrick, even though it'll be gone and over by the time you get here.
And St. Joseph.
By the time it gets to, and St. Joseph and the Annunciation.
The Annunciation. And that, did we wear a rose this weekend?
Yeah, we're halfway there.
We're more than halfway through a season that anticipates a feast.
Yeah.
And that's then, a lot going on.
And then.
Holy Week.
Holy Week. We have Passion Week. So we have that four time before Palm Sunday, and then we have Palm Sunday and Spy Wednesday, Holy Thursday. But we'll be back before then.
That's your feast day.
To give Spy Wednesday.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the betrayer's day.
When our blessed Lord
was betrayed by Judas. Yeah.
Yep. There we will see Father Kauth having to suppress his inner demons.
I can't deny it. And St. Philip Neri used to say every morning, first thing he said to our blessed Lord, one of the first things he said every single day, watch out, Lord. Today, Philip's going to betray you.
Oh,
if you begin with that notion that humble. I need his grace to be able to not betray him.
Yeah.
It's true. So
that's really,
I think I've turned this around on its head. And
precious prayer there.
It is a precious prayer.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Maybe you should say that.
Don't worry. God bless you all.
All right. Ciao. Makes me wanna scream.
Thanks for listening to this episode of From the Rooftop.
For updates about new episodes, special guests, and exclusive deals for From the Rooftop listeners, sign up at rooftoppodcast.com.
And remember, for more great ways to deepen your faith, check out all the spiritual resources available at tanbooks.com.
And we'll see you again next time
from the rooftop.